This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
China begin the implementation of a 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership agreement. The EU foreign policy chief says reaching a deal with Iran is possible amid what he calls better atmosphere and the talks to revive the JCPOA. Plus, the New York police arrest protesters demanding that the government extend a moratorium on rental evictions amid rising COVID-19 cases. Thank you for joining. The 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement between Iran and China has become operational during a visit by Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian to China. The pact will focus on economic, political, and security operation between Tehran and Beijing. Yusuf Jalali reports from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian is visiting China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
Fuad Izadi, a professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, joined us earlier. He explains why the visit of Iran's foreign minister to China is significant. Let's take a listen.
Well, I think there are two main issues. One, the 25-year agreement that was signed in Tehran when the Chinese foreign minister visited Tehran a few months ago. The agreement needs to go into details, and companies and organizations on both sides need to become active in terms of implementing the articles of the agreement. So that's one issue that I think was discussed in Beijing. The second issue is what's going on in Vienna with the nuclear talks. As you know, China is one of P4 plus one countries. China has been supportive of Iran in the last number of years, especially when Trump left the nuclear agreement. And China's support for Iran is important. Iran needs to get the sanctions lifted, and China has said that it's going to help with that issue. So the details of the negotiations, the agreement that some people expect to have in Vienna.
Iran says the United States' cruel and unilateral sanctions are to blame for suspension of its voting right in the United Nations General Assembly. Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Takht Ravanchi, says Iran is facing difficulties to pay its UN membership fee for the second straight year due to the sanctions. Takht Ravanchi says the restrictions are not just impeding Iran's access to humanitarian items, medicine, and medical equipment. It says the bans are also impeding the UN's work. The envoy said Iran is working to find a safe financial channel to pay its UN membership fee and reclaim its voting right. Diplomatic efforts are underway in the Austrian capital to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says reaching a deal with Iran is possible amid what he described as better atmosphere in the talks. He says a final deal could be concluded in the coming weeks. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Homa Lezgi from the venue of the talks in Vienna. Here's more.
We're in a stage now where the heads of the delegations of Iran and the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France and Germany, are headed back home to their political capitals. The sides have said both for further consultations and for other political engagements that these deputy foreign ministers have. But the plan is for the sides to come back here for the heads of delegations basically on Monday. And there has been no official break in the eighth round because the expert groups are still here. We're hearing that EU coordinator Enrique Mora is also going to stay on and continue his meetings here in Vienna. So the announcement is just for the heads of the Iranian and the E3 delegations going back for a short two-day break before they come back. As you said there, there was a briefing for reporters here by from a source close to the negotiations, giving us some more details or clarifications about the stage that the talks are in right now. And this source was telling us that right now is the most tedious, most difficult, and most demanding phase of the negotiation. This round, the eighth round, we have seen the beginning of serious talks, he said, on the issues that are most important. Of course, these include sanctions removal, Iran's going back to its nuclear commitments, verifications, guarantees, and sequencing. This source also said that the eighth round has been increasingly focusing on the issue of implementation or sequencing. This means the steps that need to be taken both by Iran and the Americans to go back to full compliance. So if there is an agreement to restore the JCPOA, the joint commission of the JCPOA, which is made up of Iran and the 4+1- America, which is not part of the joint commission right now, will adopt the decision, after which the Americans will announce their agreement with the text that's been agreed upon, if indeed that happens. And we will see, this source was telling us, several months as a prep period for things to basically happen for the two sides to go back to full compliance.
New York police arrest demonstrators holding a sit-in to demand government protection for tenants. The protesters called for extension of the state's eviction moratorium, which is set to expire on January 15 amid rising coronavirus cases. The expiration ends a critical economic support put in place at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. It sets the stage for a possible rush by landlords to try to evict low-income renters. Organizers are pushing for new laws to be passed for greater protection and for the moratorium to be extended until June. Coronavirus cases see a sharp rise in Latin American and Caribbean nations, contributing to record numbers of daily infections registered globally. Those nations logged a record of more than 300,000 new daily cases from January 7 until 13. Argentina was the worst affected, accounting for almost 140,000 of those cases and an average of 96 deaths. The country now has a total case tally of almost 7 million. Its death toll tops 117,000. Brazil, Colombia, and Cuba are other countries recording a steep rise in infections. Brazil has by far the highest overall deaths and caseloads in Latin America. The region's average new daily cases of over 300,000 is almost double the previous high recorded in the week ending on June the 3rd last year. Russia dismisses as baseless reports that the country is orchestrating a false flag incident in order to invade neighboring Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the allegations are unsubstantiated and not backed by evidence. Western media have said Russia has sent operatives into disputed regions in eastern Ukraine. They've quoted anonymous U.S. officials who echoed Kiev's claims that Moscow is seeking a provocation. For weeks now, the U.S. and the Western military alliance NATO have been accusing Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine. That has raised tensions with Moscow, which is unhappy with increased military activity by NATO near its borders. North Korea confirms test firing two tactical guided missiles amid growing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang says the railway-borne projectiles hit their designated targets in the EC. It says the test launches were aimed at checking the proficiency of the railway-borne regiment it first tested last September. North Korea also tested two hypersonic missiles last week. They triggered new U.S. sanctions on people involved in its ballistic weapons program. Washington says the missile tests are a threat to regional security, but Pyongyang says its tests are in self-defense amid the U.S.'s hostile policies and its joint military drills with South Korea.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension.
Resorting to sanctions at every turn will not help resolve the Korean Peninsula issue and will only intensify confrontation. We hope that all parties concerned will act prudently adhere to the right direction of dialogue and consultation, do things helpful to stabilize the situation and build mutual trust, and work together to advance the political settlement of the peninsula issue.
Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
India's Supreme Court has ordered a probe into recent incidents of hate speech against the country's Muslims. The investigation follows huge public outrage, with people questioning Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence and inaction. Munawwar Zaman has more from New Delhi.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it an encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, that's your world news for now.
What you heard
was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on surviving. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has said there was a deal to be done over the post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland after constructive talks with her European Union counterpart raised hopes of less rancorous relations with Brussels. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled "Brexit, There's a Deal to be Done Over Northern Ireland," says Liz Truss. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has said there was a deal to be done over post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland after constructive talks with her European Union counterpart raised hopes of less rancorous relations with Brussels. The notably sunny prognosis followed the first meeting between the UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss and Maroš Šefčovič, the European Commissioner responsible for Brexit issues, at Chevening, the Cabinet Minister's official country residence in Kent. In a joint European Union-UK statement, a rarity in recent years, Liz Truss and Maroš Šefčovič said intensive talks would begin next week to deal with the outstanding issues relating to Northern Ireland's place within both the European Union and UK's internal market. "We've had constructive talks with the European Union," Liz Truss said in a later interview with BBC. She added, "We're now going to go into intensive negotiations to work towards a negotiated solution to sort out these very real issues for the people of Northern Ireland." The Foreign Secretary played down the previous threats of triggering Article 16 of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, under which the United Kingdom would suspend parts of the deal previously agreed with the European Union. She said, "What I want is a negotiated solution. I think there is a deal to be done. We have had constructive talks over the last day. Of course, there is more work to do, and that is why we're intensifying the discussions. I will be seeking the Vice President again in a week's time, and I do want to make progress. Clearly, if we don't make sufficient progress, we will have to look at the alternatives, but my absolute desire is to get a deal done, a deal that works for the people of Northern Ireland." The attempt to build strong personal relations with Maroš Šefčovič at Chevening, where the two politicians walked around the state, offered a clear sign that the government is seeking to reset its relations after the resignation of Lord Frost, who often clashed with its opposing numbers in Brussels. Major differences remain between the two sides over the future implementation of the protocol, which keeps Northern Ireland in the European Union's single market for goods and draws a customs border down the Irish Sea. The European Union has offered to cut in half the number of customs checks and reduce health and safety checks on meat, plant and dairy products by up to 80%. The United Kingdom is insisting that the plans proposed do not yet live up to that promise and is pushing for a more radical overhaul that would ensure there are no checks on goods from Great Britain destined to stay in Northern Ireland. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which leads Northern Ireland's power-sharing executive, has demanded a timeline for enforcing the UK's protocol demands. Northern Ireland goes to the polls in May, and there is an expectation that the two sides will seek to strike a deal ahead of that election. Ireland's Foreign Secretary Simon Coveney welcomed the improved mood around the talks. He said, "I think it is a good thing that the Brexit issues and the protocol issues are back in the Foreign Office in London rather than in a separate unit led by Lord Frost." Meanwhile, manufacturers in Northern Ireland have ranked the post-Brexit arrangements for trade in Northern Ireland as the least of the challenges facing their businesses, according to a quarterly industry survey, with 28% saying trade with the European Union has increased over the last year. The top concern was listed as labour shortages caused by the pandemic, but also the end of freedom of movement that prevents European Union citizens living in border counties in the Republic of Ireland crossing into Northern Ireland for work. The protocol was the least of their worries, said Stephen Kelly, Chief Executive of Manufacturing Northern Ireland, which conducted the survey. "While we all get caught up in the political narrative, in business the bigger concerns are staff recruitment, productivity, and then the pandemic itself. It shows the narrative favoured by the Democratic Unionist Party and others that Northern Ireland is going to hell in a handcart because of the protocol is quite clearly not the case. Quite the opposite, Stephen Kelly said. He said there was a huge uptick in the number of firms accepting that the protocol is here to stay, but many wanted to work better through simplification of paperwork.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced. And Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him, his progeny, performed such rituals. Religions appeared one after another. All of them represented one God, one path, one origin, and one end to mankind. Every messenger who was appointed by God to convey his message informed the people of the advent of the last prophet of God. In this sense, Buddha and Krishna said the very same thing which Noah, Abraham, Moses, John, Zoroaster, and Jesus said. One told the name of the final prophet, and the other spoke of his origin. One forecast the signs of his homeland, while the other described the characteristics of his language. In one way or another, each prophet informed mankind of the joyous news of the advent of the final prophet, the last messenger of the heavens. In the very beginning of history, God sent Adam, his first prophet on earth, to propagate and show the heavenly path to the inhabitants of this world. Thousands of years have passed ever since, and some people continue to follow him by residing exclusively near the riverbanks of the world.
Zoroastrianism is one of the most ancient religions of the world. These days, most of its followers are found in Iran, India, and some regions of Central Asia. They possess a heritage several thousand years old. Like the prophets before him, Zoroaster also informed his followers of the coming of divine prophets. The religious scripts of Zoroastrianism refer to these messengers as Sotians. There are three Sotians who were foretold to appear after the Zoroaster. Alternatively, three Sotians, three beneficent personalities, will come one after the other. Throughout history, the followers of Zoroaster have been waiting for their arrival. They have searched for them everywhere.
Attilu! What brings you here?
They are visitors from the east. They follow the star. The star of the prophecy.
The prophecy of the Messiah?
The Messiah!
So far, only three Zoroastrian sages have succeeded in seeing the first Sotient in Bethlehem. When the last prophet of God appeared in Hejaz, there were many Zoroastrians who saw the signs of the second Sotient in him. They joined him in large numbers and became his followers and helpers. However, there are still many Zoroastrians who are keenly waiting for the arrival of the third Sotient. They hope that this universal reformer will appear and make the world a utopia. In India, the land of many creeds, there are several mysterious religions spread out in the vast jungles and mountainous regions. Here, you find religions such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Sikhism. Though in some case, the followers of these religions have become deviated from the right path. The depth of meaning and spirituality that these religions reveal is indicative of man's inherent tendency to establish a close relationship with an infallible creator and worship him. Historical roots of Hinduism are spread over thousands of years. Mysterious ascetics with wonderful conducts live all over India, in colorful shrines and dark temples in legendary jungles. They make the unspeakable things of this mysterious land even more mysterious.
God is one only. Even in India, in the Hindu philosophy, God is always one. But His manifestation is many.
This historical religion has several holy books as guidelines for its followers. These books are full of strange and unsaid mysteries. Among the sacred books of Hindus are the Puranas. These ancient books contain the history of the universe, the genealogy of kings and heroes, and the foretelling of future events. In these books, we again witness indications of the coming of a spiritual teacher called Muhammad from a foreign land. To him is what Raja Bhuj respectfully says, "I prostrate myself before you, O you, the pride of mankind, the inhabitant of Arabia. You have gathered a great power to eradicate Satan."
In one of the Puranas in India, Bhavishya Purana, it is also mentioned that Mahamud, Paigambar Muhammad, will be born in the Middle East, and he would cleanse the people of corruption and bad habits there, and you know, he will bring a new wave of devotion. This is mentioned thousands of years ago in the Hindu texts, in a Purana. It's one verse is there, one quote is there, that such and such a person, a prediction was done about that.
He will appear in a sandy desert in the land of Arabia. He will be known as the pride of humanity, and his name is Muhammad. What could be the secret that has been also mentioned in the holy books of Hindus, and of which the Hindu monks have spoken? The history of Jainism goes back about 600 years before the appearance of Christ. According to Jainism, salvation can only be achieved through the practice of asceticism. The tenets of this faith dictate that God has 24 avatars on earth. The last one of them will be born in a peninsula, and the name of his father is Vishnu Bhagat, which is the equivalent of Abdullah. And the name of his mother is Somanib, which is the equivalent of Amina. He is said to be taught by Bhagwan in a cave. Sikhs, who wear a unique turban on their head, are followers of another religion in India. But are there any hints about the holy prophet of Islam and his religion in the scriptures of Sikhs? In addition to the promise made thousands of years ago by Eastern religions concerning the advent of a prophet called Muhammad in Arabia, Abrahamic religions also foretell the arrival of a great prophet on earth in the last age of humanity. Moses and Jesus endured many difficulties on the path of propagating their messages. They promised the people about the advent of a man from among the descendants of Abraham. The New Testament clearly promises the arrival of a prophet after Christ. An example of this can be seen in the Gospel of John. Shortly before the advent of Christ, Roman oppression was continuously increasing. More and more innocent people were crucified every day, and the poor were made even poorer through forced taxes. In such conditions, a man called John, from the shores of the Jordanian River, claimed prophecy. He kindled both doubt and hope in the hearts of the Jews of his time. Perhaps they wondered whether he was Messiah, the prophet foretold to end pain and tragedy. On the same day, Jewish leaders sent a group of Levites to John to investigate the matter.
Who are you?
John confessed. He did not deny. He answered,
I am not the Messiah.
Who are you then?
Are you Elijah?
No, I'm not.
Are you the prophet?
No.
Then tell us who you are.
We have to take an answer back to those
when
who sent
Prophet
us.
John replied that he was not Messiah, Elijah, or the promised prophet, the delegates, who were considering the new prophet to be one of these three, asked him in wonder,
if you're not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet, why do you baptize?
I baptize with water. But among you stands the one you do not know. He is coming after me, but I'm not good enough even to untie his sandals.
John's Gospel contains a marvelous secret within it. This secret, which reveals itself exclusively to those possessing wisdom and intellect, promises the advent of another prophet after Jesus. It speaks of a messenger for whom everyone is waiting. When Christ embarked upon his three-year-long mission, a great disagreement occurred among people.
And whoever believes in me should drink. As the scripture says, streams of life-giving water will pour out from his side. This man is really the prophet. The Messiah will not come from Galilee.
Many people said that he was the Messiah promised by the Bible. However, others did not agree to this and said that perhaps he was the foretold prophet. What we can understand from John's Gospel is that apart from Elijah, two other people must also come to mankind. One is the Messiah, and the other is, for the lack of a better title, the prophet. But where is the prophet, who according to John's Gospel must come, and has yet to come?
All the Christianity believe in the genuineness of Prophet Muhammad, believe that he was a prophet or not.
I do not know for all of Christianity. I have no doubt myself he is a prophet and spoke the word of God with great love and kindness and beauty.
Yes.
The prophet is a symbol. The prophet is a human being. Human being, not God. He's a human being that he had great faith, a maximum of the faith, and he was in contact with God when he was alive. And he passed the messages of God to the people.
Will Durant writes, according to the documents discovered on the shores of the Dead Sea, people were awaiting the foretold prophet, whose appearance, along with that of the Messiah, was promised. But who is this prophet, and from where does he originate? In order to answer this question, we will have to go back and investigate his characteristics, as found in the Old Testament. According to the Old Testament, Moses saved the children of Israel from the Egyptians' bondage and made them cross the sea. He guided them during the course of 40 years of wandering in the Sinai Desert, until they reached the banks of the Jordanian River. Nevertheless, the Israelites continued their lives as nomads. For this reason, Moses gathered them all and said, God told me, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all, that I shall command him,
And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. The Bible only recognizes the children of Ishmael as the brethren of the Israelites. Hence, the foretold prophet must have been raised among the brethren of the Israelites. He must have been given a book like that of Moses, and he must have come with a religious law like that of Moses. The question stands, to which prophet can all these qualities be attributed? Priest James Dow writes in the Collins Dictionary of the Bible, "The only personality for whom the forecast of Torah can fit is Muhammad, because he is the only person who resembles Moses and has a book and a religious law." The prophets came one after the other and guided humanity towards the truth. Every prophet promised his followers about the advent of the last messenger of God, Muhammad, about whom the Puranas had promised, the second sociant of the Zoroastrians, a prophet from Arabia, the last avatar riding on a horse, the prophet resembling Moses, and the descendant of the brethren of the Israelites, and the prophet mentioned in John's Gospel. Who is he? In which land was he raised? In which era did he render as true the promise of all the prophets before him, after centuries of denial and defiance by the unbelievers? Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, titled as Ahmad, the seal of all prophets, from the house of Ishmael, appeared in the land of the Arabs to guide mankind, so that man may not remain in the darkness of ignorance. And now, on the threshold of another millennium, man continues the path of his predecessors in the persecution of the propagators of the message of God, those who decapitated Prophet John, put the cross on the shoulders of Christ, and mounted the Crusades, are once again continuing with their blasphemous persecution of the last prophet of God. They fed their ancient grudge. They despised the sacred. And driven to despair, they set fire to the truth and tried desperately to injure the prophet.
There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God.
In the limelight.
Humanitarian organization CARE International has published its annual report of the 10 countries that had the least attention in online articles in 5 languages around the world in 2021, despite each having at least 1 million people affected by war and conflict or climate disasters. We now present you an article written by Saeed Kamali-Dehan under the heading "World's Poorest Bear Brunt of Climate Crisis: 10 Underreported Emergencies." Please stay with us for more of Saeed Kamali-Dehan's article. from Afghanistan to Ethiopia, about 235 million people worldwide needed assistance in 2021. But while some crises received global attention, others are lesser known. Humanitarian organization CARE International has published its annual report of the 10 countries that had the least attention in online articles in five languages around the world in 2021, despite each having at least 1 million people affected by warring conflict or climate disasters. Laurie Lee, the Chief Executive Officer of CARE International UK, said the findings from a collaboration between the charity and international media monitoring service Meltwater highlighted how the accelerating climate crisis is fueling many of the world's emergencies. Laurie Lee said, "There is deep injustice at the heart of it. The world's poorest are bearing the brunt of climate change, poverty, migration, hunger, gender inequality, and even more scarce resources, despite having done the least to cause it." He said, "Add COVID-19 into the mix and we see decades of purported progress towards tackling inequality, poverty, conflict and hunger disappearing before our eyes. The number of people in need of humanitarian aid is expected to rise to 274 million people this year, or 1 in 28 people. And more than 84 million people have been uprooted." Laurie Lee highlighted the impact of the UK's 2021 foreign aid budget cut, saying that it resulted in over £166 million less in humanitarian aid reaching the 10 countries mentioned in this report compared to 2019. Zambia, first on the list. Zambia has 1.2 million malnourished people and about 60% of the 18.4 million population living below the international poverty line of $1.90 a day. Women produce 60% of the country's food supply, but families headed by women face higher poverty rates than those headed by men. Food insecurity in Zambia has primarily been blamed on prolonged drought, but rising corn prices and flooding have also contributed. Ukraine, currently in the news amid renewed tensions between Russia and the West. In Ukraine, 3.4 million people were in need of assistance in 2021 after years of conflict. The report said while a comprehensive political solution for the conflict is still not in sight, people in eastern Ukraine are daily forced to put their lives on the line. Along the 420-kilometer contact line that separates Ukrainian government-controlled territory from that of the separatists in the east of the country, the situation is particularly dangerous. Malawi is facing a food insecurity crisis, with 17% of the population severely malnourished. Droughts, floods, landslides have all been predicted to worsen over the coming years. Cyclone Idai in 2019 severely affected harvests and left tens of thousands of people displaced. Chikondi Chabuta, advocacy lead for CARE International in Malawi, said, "The climate crisis is hitting people here earlier and much harder than the people of the global north. We are already seeing real-life consequences with delayed rainfall, heavy and destructive rainfall, unpredictable rainfall patterns, infertile soil, and destroyed harvests." Central African Republic. In Central African Republic, where civil war has exacerbated the humanitarian crisis, half of the population face food insecurity. A ceasefire agreement struck in October of 2021 is fragile, and more than 700,000 people have been internally displaced, more than half of them children. The Central African Republic is ranked second to last globally on the Human Development Index. The report said, on average, a child attends school for just under 4 years, and girls for only 3 years. About 30% of children are in work. Guatemala. Poverty, violence, and the climate crisis are leading problems in Guatemala, which is on the migratory route to Mexico and onwards to the United States. Two-thirds of the population live on less than $2 a day, and 38% of the population face food insecurity. The report said camps sheltering those sent back to Mexico are overcrowded, meaning many live on the streets of Guatemala. Guatemala is considered one of the world's most dangerous countries, with 3,500 murders in 2020 alone. The report said, although about 3.3 million people in the country rely on humanitarian aid, the frequent occurrence of violence is in many cases a barrier to accessing urgently needed assistance. Colombia. Nearly 5 million people live under the control of armed groups in Colombia, and 6.7 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid. Food insecurity has been blamed on an economic recession caused by the pandemic. It has particularly affected indigenous communities in Colombia, those uprooted internally, and 1.8 million refugees, mainly in northern Colombia. Burundi, ranked as the country gaining the least attention in 2020, Burundi was seventh in 2021 with 2.3 million refugees.